I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. The Atlantic coast has three running offshore wind farms generating power. Several more are on the way. The first offshore wind farm getting close to approval in the Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, Delmarva coast is U.S. Wind's Project of the Coast of Ocean City, Maryland. The project has been in the making for almost a decade, but recently they received approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, and are now in front of the Maryland Public Service Commission, the state's utility regulator, with a long-term fixed-priced offer for the state to buy the entire output from the wind farm, expected to be about 900 megawatts, which, if approved, will both allow the project to move forward and tie the state's ratepayers to that price. If you ever wondered about electricity law and renewables policy, stay tuned to hear U.S. Wind's CEO, Jeff Grabowski, break down one of the most complex domains of public policy.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program, where you'll learn to shape public policy, impact communities, and function at the center of modern society. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from the Washington, D.C. rock and roll band Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersluis on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs, Neutro and Juniper. Don't want decisions ruling my life. Won't pick up my phone if it rings all night. Ask me anything, it's all right. I'll tell you I'm neutral. I'm really, really neutral. Yeah.
Jeff Grabowski, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Your company, U.S. Wind, has received approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to build the first offshore wind generation project off the coast of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. You've just presented your application to the Maryland Public Service Commission, the state's regulator. What are the next steps here?
We've proposed to the state of Maryland the largest clean energy project that's ever been proposed in the state of Maryland. It's a 1,700 megawatt offshore wind farm. And just to give you a little context, that's enough power in the course of a year to power about 600,000 homes.
Is this in phases or is it right away?
Yeah, that's right. It's in phases. So 1,700 megawatts of offshore wind power will require us to erect about 114 turbines. So obviously it takes time to install each of them. So our plan is to build the project in phases over about 3 years in the water. We began planning this project about 8 years ago. We're getting closer. I don't want to say we're inching closer. I think we're doing better than inches at this point, but we are progressing, but it's a lot of work to go.
8 years is a long time. The United States has not been very friendly to offshore wind, certainly not compared to the UK or China. Can you describe what these 8 years have been like?
One thing to start with is that this is not unique to offshore wind. Why does it take so long to build anything in the United States? components of the transportation network or power plants or housing, whatever it is, we're really slow at building it. And that is something that I think as a society, we need to grapple with. Why have we set up structures in our political and our political system that make everything so complex? We're a very litigious place. You know, project opponents have extensive opportunities to slow projects down and to challenge them. And I think the consequence of that is that we see that there are lots of infrastructure needs in the United States that are being unmet. And offshore wind is one little example. We just happen to be maybe on the extreme edge of what of the complexity because we're so new. Now, offshore wind isn't so novel globally. You know, there are 12,000 offshore turbines in operation today. The first offshore project was constructed in 1991 in Denmark and operated for about 25 years, and then it was decommissioned. So we've already seen cycles of offshore wind farms live their entire lives in operation in other parts of the world and be decommissioned before the U.S. has really even gotten started. We've been dealing with the regulatory approval process for quite a number of years now. And that's at its heart what we've been doing.
But explain that a little bit. It's not just regulatory approval, right? You said we are a particularly litigious country. We have lots of veto points from opponents. So what specifically applied to you and to your project?
One of the unique aspects of building energy infrastructure is that we have to deal with the federal government, the state government, and local governments.
Is it the case that in a place like Denmark or the UK, that these echelons of governments do not exist and there is only one negotiation level?
In some of these countries that have developed at least offshore wind more rapidly, there is more coordinated effort at a national level to set energy policy. And then mechanisms are in place to move that policy forward, and there are fewer veto points. It's not a thing in the US where the federal government just says, you shall build X, Y, or Z, and it just happens, and states and local governments don't have a say.
Is federalism an impediment to infrastructure development? At some point, they did build things and did it well. Do you have a sense of that?
Infrastructure has to exist in a physical space. It has to be somewhere. And it's almost, most of the infrastructure is within a state. The state itself has a lot of say over the use of its land and the impacts that that projects have on their community. So now there are some mechanisms at the federal level where the federal government through FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and other entities are allowed to assert federal jurisdiction and overcome some state objections. But that still is a pretty cumbersome process, and we have a legal system that's set up to challenge those decisions. So in order to build these projects, it's up to the project developer to piece all of these all these things together. The federal approvals, the state approvals.
Your project is in the water, which is federal jurisdiction. What do states have to do with it?
The first obvious thing is that the power has to come ashore somewhere. Those 114 turbines are connected on shore with four cables. Once those cables cross the 3-mile limit from shore, they are in state jurisdiction. So we then need to get approvals from state governments to use essentially what is state submerged land and to cross things like beaches. There's another aspect of state jurisdiction that states control the energy mix within their states. Right. So states get to pick essentially and give preference to what kind of energy sources do we want our state to use.
What are the four places where you're bringing back cables from the sea into Maryland?
Those four cables are all going to eventually end up adjacent to the last coal-fired power plant on the Delmarva Peninsula. It's at the western edge of Indian River Bay in Delaware. Just to the north of the Maryland-Delaware state line is a big old coal plant called the Indian River Generating Station. We will be plugging the wind farm essentially into that spot on the grid. That coal plant will retire and go away, and we will be replacing the that power generation that's coming from coal with power that's coming from offshore wind.
You are also applying to Delaware at the same time as in Maryland. Is that the case then?
We do have to get approvals from Delaware as well.
There are no cables located in Maryland?
No. If you can think about the electric system in the region is really a set of physical wires and substations and things like that. The electrons that come from the wind farm, they don't know if they're in Delaware or Maryland. And the electrons go where the load is. Plugging into the grid means that we are serving anyone who's on that grid. We have a huge regional grid that stretches from the Atlantic coast all the way to the Great Lakes to Ohio and Illinois, right? That's the grid. And it's sort of managed by one entity that governs the grid for all of those states. And then once you've plugged into the grid, there's a separate system where states like Maryland can claim the electrons on the grid that are being that are coming from a wind farm or from a coal plant or something else. So there's this distinction between the physical interconnection and, let's say, the legal interconnection. So Maryland gets to claim those electrons and say, those are ours. And there's this whole background system that kind of sort of, it's like a banking system for electricity. It's this complicated sort of financial transaction system that's separate from the physical system.
What part of Maryland land, submerged or not, are you using?
There are no turbines in Maryland waters. The closest point the turbines are in the Atlantic Ocean are about 11 miles to shore. The turbines are all in federal waters. The connection happens on the peninsula, on the Delaware side of the peninsula, and the state of Maryland is getting all the credit for the power.
Delaware is not asking for any apportionment?
No. What this means is that when we tally up the, where does Maryland get its power from? Maryland will get credit for the all the power that comes from this wind farm. So the generation that Maryland gets from wind right now is about 1% of all the power that Maryland uses. We'll go from 1% to 20% with this wind farm. Maryland's clean energy goals, climate reduction goals, will take an enormous step forward by using the output of this wind farm.
So what are the numbers are we talking about?
If you think about 1,700 megawatts, you know, that's a big nuclear power plant, right? We're not running 24/7 like a nuclear power plant is. But let's say an offshore wind farm of 1,700 megawatts is kind of the equivalent of a, you know, 900 megawatt big coal or nuclear plant. So this is a really substantial power plant.
When these four cables are coming in, they are they under the beach?
Everything's buried. Nothing is overhead. You know, none of the cables will ever be visible because the cables, when they're offshore, are buried about 3 to 6 feet deep in the seabed. And then they're buried 30, 40, 50 feet under the beach. And they are then buried all the way under the beach and under Indian River Bay until the cables pop up on the land that the substation is in. So they are plugged directly into the equipment at the substation.
So one of the oppositions to wind farms, offshore wind farms, has been that, well, you know, the local economy is disrupted.
Yeah, we don't think that's true at all. And I think the experience that we've seen, both from other parts of the world and the experience we have here in the U.S. directly, contradicts that view. We've seen, for instance, with the first wind farm, offshore wind farm built in the United States, the Block Island Wind Farm, which I developed and built a number of years ago, that in the years after the wind farm was built, academic studies have shown that tourism, if anything, increased. There's some folks who will tell researchers, I don't want to stand on the beach if I can see a turbine on the horizon. There are other people who want to see the turbine on the horizon, and a lot of people who just don't care either way. And on net, it looks like offshore wind has not much of a negative impact at all, and in many cases looks like it will be a positive impact from a tourism perspective. Now, in addition to that, we obviously are creating jobs, right? And so we are, I think, a great net generator of economic development in a state and even in a coastal community.
Can you compare the opposition you faced on Block Island to the opposition you faced from Ocean City, even Delaware?
If I think back to the early days of proposing the wind farm off of Block Island, which was only 3 miles off of the island, right, as opposed to our project, which is where the closest turbine is 11 miles away, and some of the turbines off Ocean City will be, you know, 25 miles away. So the Block Island project, much smaller, but also much closer to shore. There was a fair amount of local opposition that was based in people not really knowing what to expect. And I would say in the early days, it seemed like it was always 50-50. 50% of people were sort of in favor of the clean energy project. 50% of the people were opposed. We didn't know which way it was eventually going to end up. And then we built the project. And the opposition just sort of melted away, and most of the opponents became neutral to positive. We're in a pretty divided time, a partisan time, right? And everything is seen through partisan glasses sometimes. And social media sort of has revved up the ability to sort of create controversy. That is definitely a different challenge, you know. Even in the last 10 years, it's a very different world. There are many, many legitimate questions about what will the wind farm look like? Mm-hmm. What will I hear it? Will I see it? How will it affect fish? How will it affect birds? How will it affect whales? Those are all totally appropriate, good questions, and we try our best to answer them. What is different is that while many people have, I think, good, genuine, honest questions and are just looking for information and looking for the facts, there are certainly some folks out there who, at least in my view, no matter how many times we explain an issue, they will simply deny that that is true and attribute the worst possible motives to anything that could possibly be associated with the project.
Can you speak to the research that there is on marine life in particular?
We have conducted very extensive site investigations where we've sent research vessels out to the wind farm site, taking samples of the seabed, drilling into the seabed to see what the geology is like, sending drones down to study the marine habitat and to sort of quantify and identify the fish species. We did it over time, so we have a measure of sort of fish over time and the different types of species. We've studied everything from marine mammals to turtles to seabirds, you name it, we've studied it. And, you know, we have literally thousands and thousands of pages of scientific and expert reports that then all collectively go to the federal and state agencies, who have to make sure that we are abiding by a variety of very stringent federal laws, like the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act. Here's the great thing about offshore wind. There are very, very few birds that fly at the turbine height 11 miles offshore.
What is the turbine height?
Up to about 900 feet. Wind onshore is more challenging in terms of sighting where you're going to avoid bird activity than offshore. So if you think about offshore activity, you have basically two big categories of birds. You've got shorebirds like loons or ducks. They fly very, very low. They're essentially flying on right out above the water, right? They're not hundreds of feet in the air. And they're also all kind of sporadic at 11, 15, 20 miles offshore. There are some, but they're very low flying. They have essentially the wind farm will have very little, if any, impact on them. And then you have migrating species, some of these little songbirds that are migrating for hundreds and hundreds of miles. They're flying up to 5,000 feet in the air, way, way, way above the wind farm.
Are you also using high frequency noise to keep birds out?
No, we don't do that. We do have some measures, some like physical measures, like the kind of things you might see on on buildings to like anti-perching.
So you said 11 to 25 miles. Is that even visible?
It's not beyond visual range. You can see turbines at certainly at that 11 mile distance. Now, they're not all at 11 miles, right? Because we have this lease in federal waters that's 80,000 acres large. If you're standing on the beach and the weather conditions are right, then yes, you will see turbines offshore. The turbines don't dominate the coast.
If you're in a boat, how close can you get to the turbines?
Well, as close as you safely can get is probably the right answer. So there's no restriction. The wind farm is completely open to all vessel traffic that can safely navigate the wind farm. So the turbines, you know, they're set out in a grid. North to south, they're about a mile apart. And east to west, they're about 8/10 of a mile apart. There's quite a bit of space between them. And so certainly all the types of vessels that folks would normally be taking from, you know, from the coastal areas in Maryland can easily maneuver through the wind farm, I think. Certainly we expect that big tankers and cargo vessels are going to stay in their lane offshore. They're not coming through the wind farm. But I will tell you that at other projects, like at the Block Island project, that Block Island project is extremely popular with recreational fishermen.
Why?
Because the turbines become artificial reefs for marine life. And so very quickly, within months of the foundations being installed, sea life is growing on the foundations. And so you get mussels and vegetation start to grow on that foundation that attracts small fish, and the small fish attract medium-sized fish, and those attract big fish. So one of the things that we will study over time is what kind of sea life tends to propagate in which parts of the wind farm.
Are there other technical aspects to having an offshore wind farm in this region, right? So is it hurricanes are you concerned about? Is there anything about the seabed?
One of the reasons that Maryland is such a good location is that the seabed off of the coast is extremely uniform and unchallenging from a technical perspective. So it's a pretty sandy seabed. And so that's unlike other parts of the Atlantic coast. If you go further north, you have a much rockier seabed because of the extent of ice sheets from the last sort of glacial maximum. The other sort of technical issue that is certainly front of mind for offshore wind, but anyone building anything these days anywhere near the coast, is the increased frequency and intensity of storms. For the most part, we offshore wind farms like storms. We benefit when big storms come up the Atlantic because that produces a lot of energy. Obviously, there's a point at which the storm is too strong. The wind farm is actually sending laser inputs out towards the direction of the wind and can measure the wind that's on its way. So we can sense when the wind is going to pick up to the point at which the wind farm needs to go into a shutdown mode, which essentially parks the wind farm in neutral. So instead of the wind turning the blades kind of automatically turn in a direction where the wind isn't putting force on the turbine anymore.
What is too strong, though?
Right around 65 miles an hour or so of wind is when we go into neutral. Can the wind farm survive a Category 3 hurricane, right? Yes, we can. The regulators at the federal level need to be convinced that the wind farm can survive kind of these extreme weather events.
All right, let's come back to land. So you were connected to the Indian River coal-fired plant that is being decommissioned, and you are connecting to the PJM, the regional grid that supplies everything from New Jersey to Illinois, and Maryland and Delaware are both part of it. Now, we had Fred Hoover, the chair of the Maryland Public Service Commission, on the show recently, and he said that there were the renewable projects were having difficulty getting interconnection with PJM. What is your experience? How's that going?
as a new power plant, we have to essentially apply to get connected to the grid. And that's part of the development process that's been going on for the number of years now. And so we have our place in line. The earliest we could really be interconnected, given the sort of processes that are in place, are around 2028 for the first phase of the project. This is the biggest issue in the electricity business today, right now, is this issue, right? This interconnections to the grid. We are undergoing in the energy space right now, in the electricity space, this revolution that is connected to AI and data centers. And all of a sudden, we have this huge demand for more energy that we did not have. So if you go back for the last 20 years, in the first 20 years of the 2000s, electricity demand in the United States grew by a little less than 1% a year, right? And actually started contracting in the late 2010s. Like, demand was going down. And we've gone from that world where essentially flat demand to demand that's growing at 2 to 3% a year for the next several decades. Now, for a lot of businesses, growth of 2 to 3% a year would not sound particularly exciting. But in the electricity business, it's earth-shaking news, right? It is, because it takes 10 years to build a power plant. It takes 15 years to build transmission. Like, it takes long, long times to build stuff. So the energy business right now is grappling with this huge issue that just has started to develop, because we are suddenly facing a future with enormous demands for new sources of electricity. And that's not what any of us, no one saw the AI, no one in the energy sector, I don't think, saw the AI boom coming as quickly and as large as it did. And so that AI is causing folks like Google and Amazon and everyone else to need to build these huge new data centers that consume massive amounts of energy, at the same time that electric vehicle demand is growing. And we're seeing things like new manufacturing for cars, for electric cars, for solar panels, for battery technology, lots of new manufacturing investments in the United States. And then we have things like heat pumps in homes, replacing furnaces. Like, the demands on the electricity system are really increasing. So now you've got the PJM system that's trying to interconnect new projects. And it takes a while to interconnect these new projects. And so how do we make our existing system for building energy match up with the world of high-tech demand? And right now, those two things don't match very well at all.
What does PJM need to do now?
Interconnection. It's not just a matter of paperwork, right? This is, at the end of the day, we're plugging a 1,700-megawatt wind farm into a place that used to have a 400-megawatt coal plant. PJM needs to make physical upgrades to the electric system in that area. And so that will mean new power lines, new substations that essentially radiate out from that Indian River power plant. The first step is for PJM to figure out precisely what are all the changes to the electric system that need to happen.
Okay, so it's not in the building stage, it's still in the conceptual stage.
It probably won't kick off for the building stage and sometime next year.
It seems that as demand is going up, power is going to be more expensive. In terms of financing renewable, one of the issues was that it wasn't viable. But as electricity prices go up, the viability improves for renewable projects. What is kind of the viability you are projecting, at least publicly?
So we have this enormous upfront cost, and then we get paid in little chunks over many, many years, right? As the wind farm produces energy, we get a return on that investment, but it takes 20 years for that to all work out. What you really need is a contract up front where someone says, okay, we're going to buy that power. If you build the project and you produce the power, we're going to buy that power from you at a fixed price. In this case, we're negotiating with the Public Service Commission, whereby the state of Maryland will buy the energy over the course of a number of years. And once we have that level of certainty that there's a customer at a price, we can then make the commitment to actually come up with the money and build the project and take that risk over the next 20 years that the wind farm is going to work.
Is there an offer on the table?
That is what the Public Service Commission is considering right now.
What is that?
That is something that's not disclosed by the Public Service Commission at this point. And they'll make a decision by January on whether our proposal meets the statutory requirements. So in Maryland, there are ratepayer protections in place that essentially set a maximum cap. And at the end of the process, they'll either say, you didn't pass the tests, we reject it, or you did pass the tests.
Now, when you say Maryland pays, so do you get paid technically from the utilities?
The way the state has set up this mechanism is instead of our wind farm having separate contracts with each of the utilities, we have one mechanism where we will essentially bill the state. There's a third-party administrator that collects the funds from all the utilities and then distributes them to us, depending on the load.
It's an agent of the state and not just...
It's an agent of the Public Service Commission, I think is a fair way to put it, yeah.
Huh. Okay. Jeff Grabowski, thank you for taking the time to explain one of the most complicated areas of public policy today. And I suppose you've been doing it for 8 years, so you have some practice. Please come back when you have more news.
Sunil, really appreciate the time to talk about this stuff. Happy to be back as well.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
What lessons can we draw from my conversation with Jeff Grabowski, US Wind's CEO? First, power policy is complicated in a way that I don't think housing or even education are. US Wind's project is almost entirely located in federal waters. The power lands in the state of Delaware and is fed into the regional grid that serves all states between New Jersey and Illinois. But Maryland is going to legally buy all the power generated and do so on a fixed price, long-term contract that ties all the parties, including Maryland ratepayers. But without that long-term contract, this project would not be viable. Talk about the government taking on risk. We don't almost ever talk about this function of the government, economic risk-taking. But in a modern economy, it is not just the joint stock company or the mutual fund or the pension fund that spread and manage risk. The only entity that truly spreads risk across all of society is the government. But risk-taking is inherently risky. So what happens when a government makes a bet that fails? Rocket ships, we understand. But it is also true of aluminum plants and auto manufacturers. One of the Biden administration's signature risky bets are the new semiconductor plants it has supported. How should risky government bets be managed politically? We don't know, but we certainly hate the uncertainty. Second, Jeff Grabowski talked about how building infrastructure in the United States is more expensive and time-consuming than in most other advanced countries in the world. This is actually what research shows across the board. It takes about $1.6 billion to build 1 mile of underground rail in the United States. But Italy can do the same thing for $250 million or so. Federalism and veto points are said to be the causes. But what is truly interesting about this conclusion is that the United States has time and again shown extreme agility and incomparable ability to jump back from economic downturns. post-pandemic economic growth in the United States can only be described as extraordinary when compared with Europe, Japan, or China. So how is it that in one sector of economic management, building infrastructure, the United States fails badly? But in another sector of economic management, business cycles, the United States outperforms all other advanced countries. In fact, the experience of US and Europe are quite the opposite. Europe does poorly on business cycle management, but better on infrastructure development. If regulation coordination and veto points are a problem in infrastructure development, is market management not subject to those constraints in the US? But in Europe, the situation is reversed, and market management is subject to constraints while infrastructure is not. The proposition that emerges from this observation is whether there is a compensating relationship between infrastructure regulation and market regulation. Market deregulation is only possible when infrastructure development, a highly political activity, is heavily regulated. Conversely, greater market regulation allows governments in Europe to move faster on infrastructure development. A full discussion of why this should be will have to wait, but a possible variable might be political trust. Enforcing market regulation builds public trust such that governments have an easier time approving risky infrastructure projects. Think about it and send me a voice letter if you have thoughts. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analyses. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Arima Gay, with support from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. rock and roll band Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersloos on drums. You can find their newest Fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs in this episode, Neutral and Juniper. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihbpod.org. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. See you next time.